everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Biography. I'm Mark Klobis, your host for the channel. Today we're talking with Susan Rubinstein DeMazzi about her new book about the journalist, playwright, and New Deal official Henry Alsberg, entitled Henry Alsberg, The Driving Force of the New Deal Federal Writers Project. Sue, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's our pleasure. I wonder if you could start us off by telling us something about yourself.
Sure. I started as a freelance writer. I wrote for the New York Times and lots of other publications. I've done a little playwriting, some screenwriting, and then I became a community college librarian, and that's at Suffolk County Community College on Long Island. And, you know, while I was there, you get a lot of time to do research, and you find out a lot of things while you're doing research that you might not have known about. So that's how I found out about Henry Alsberg.
So you were doing this research about Henry Alsberg. What basically put you over that threshold from doing, you know, looking up information about Henry Alsberg to deciding that you wanted to write a book about him?
Well, actually, what happened was I was doing research for someone at the college about Jackie Robinson, actually. And I ended up at the Library of Congress website. And you know how you're on a website and you kind of get led to different places. And I came across something called the Federal Writers Project, which was an AG of the WPA in the 1930s, New Deal AG. And I never heard of the Federal Writers Project. And I'll tell you, I guess, a little bit more about that later. And so I really started doing research on the Federal Writers Project. And as I was doing research on the Federal Writers Project, I just couldn't believe I'd never heard of it. And I couldn't believe most other people had never heard of it. And then I came across the person who directed it, and that was Henry Alsberg. So it really was sort of serendipitous, I guess. And the more I started kind of just on the side when I was not busy with other things, you know, at home or on the weekends or in the summer, I started looking into him and I found out all sorts of interesting things about him. You know, his political work, his journalism work, and then what he actually did with the Federal Writers Project. And I decided I should look for a book. I want to read more about him. And I went to look for a biography and none existed. And I said, maybe there should be a biography about Henry Alsberg. And that's sort of how it started. And I started sending out proposals to publishers. And then I was able to get a contract, which was sort of shocking, but exciting, too. So that's really how it started. It really started with Jackie Robinson, which is kind of funny.
I just find it fascinating, though, that yours is the first biography, not just because, you know, he had this important role in the New Deal, but also he, as you describe it, he had such a fascinating life, and he had a life, and it wasn't just him. I mean, he had this fascinating family. I was wondering if you could explain a bit about his background and his family's background, because it was a family of incredibly accomplished people.
It really was. Well, his parents were, well, his father was a German immigrant. His mother was born here, but it was a German Jewish family. They were pretty agnostic. Actually, his father was described as fiercely agnostic. And he had a brother, Carl. He had two brothers and a sister. His brother, Carl, was one of the first heads of the FDA. It wasn't called the FDA then. It was like in the early 1900s. So his brother was very involved in government and worked in Washington for a long time. So thank goodness for that, because there were biographies, one or two biographies written about his brother. So that helped me learn about his early life. And it was a very intellectual and progressive family. His father and his brothers were more into kind of lean towards science. And his Henry and his sister, I'm going to call him Henry if that's okay. Henry and his sister kind of leaned towards the arts more. You know, he was a cello player. He was, you know, in college, he was a writer. His sister was into kind of helping immigrants at the time, and this was in the early 1900s. So his mother's family was a little bit more eccentric, so there were some stories about them that were I guess eccentric is a good word. So, but his father's family was more kind of scientific and by the book kind of people.
It was interesting. I one of the passages that stands out is when you describe going back to how fiercely agnostic, as you put it, they were, was how his father had his students reading, had his children reading Thomas Huxley rather than
right.
You know, religious texts. And yet it's interesting that you posit that it was the fact that Henry was the youngest, that he didn't quite seem to fall into that scientific orbit. And yet, as you describe, he had a very, he was academically very accomplished. You mentioned he started Columbia College at the age of 15.
Right, which was really amazing when you look at the kinds of requirements they had to get into college back then, and especially into Columbia. So yeah, he was brilliant, really. As were the rest of them, actually.
And
his father was a chemist, so they came from a professional background.
And as you describe, he not only starts his education at his college education at a very precocious age, he also early on is very precocious about his politics. And I was wondering if you could explain a bit more about that, because that is a thread that runs through the entire book.
Well, I think one thing was, I feel like I never could really, without him actually saying I rebelled against my father in, letters or correspondence, I do feel like he did rebel a little bit against that, because he really went into possibly not being religious, but really working for Jewish organizations for, a good 10 solid years of his life. So that was one thing. And his rebellion, it started pretty early. He considered himself, I guess, a little different than his classmates at Columbia. And, it's hard to say, because you have to really have proof of, through either correspondence or letters or something about how he felt. But later on, many years after he graduated, he talked about how he wasn't like the rest of them. And I think part of it was because he was gay, and I think he didn't quite identify with everybody else. Whether he identified at a young age as being gay, it's hard to know. But later on he did, and I guess he felt separate from everybody for one of those reasons. And he was also attracted, I think, pretty early on to the anarchist cause, because they were like the only political group in America that kind of accepted homosexuals. So I think that was a big part of it.
You make this one intriguing hypothesis where you describe how when his class was graduating, they took this anonymous poll, which they aligned themselves politically, and you describe how many of them identified themselves as Democrat, Republican, Independent, and yet there was one person in the entire class who identified as a radical. And I was wondering if you could kind of explain, how you drew that conclusion there.
Well, it's funny, because I looked at – I have the 1900 class book, and what was it called? I have it here. The Naughty Naughtians. It was the 1900 class book where people described themselves. So there were little biographies about each person. And so I was looking through it, and I went to Columbia University and looked at their archives to try to figure out if it was indeed him. And there were maybe one or two other people who kind of leaned towards more progressive kinds of lifestyles. So, I think I put in the book that it wasn't, I couldn't say 100% that it was him, but it really did seem like it was him, because he really did go on to live the most radical kind of life. So it made sense to me that he was the one. And it was a very small class. So it was likely that he was the one who that would fit the bill.
You describe how, early on he, he realizes he's gay. He, you describe how, that kind of puts him out of, in a sense, at that time, there was not necessarily, for lack of a better word, a niche for him.
And no, it was very, and it was unsafe. It was dangerous.
Yes. And you also describe how he also seemed to have difficulty finding a niche professionally. And in a way, it seems to run through his entire life. But early on, when he graduates from college, he seems to shift from one profession to another. Almost, and what made it so fascinating was the fact that it was also seamless. It wasn't as though he had to go back and undergo a lot of retraining, or he had to go and make a series of connections. He seemed to go from one to another almost as though it was part of a much, kind of like there's a much broader label of writer activist that he was, and that he you know, kind of assumes early on, even though he's not just a journalist or just a lawyer or just a political activist.
Yeah, he really did move. His whole life he did that. He zigzagged kind of from one, you know, from law to literature. It just wasn't out of character for him. And sometimes I think it was his restlessness. He would get bored, I think, kind of more easily than the next person. And with law, by the way, I think he didn't like it. Actually, I know he didn't like it. It was obvious through some interviews and some correspondence that he really didn't like it. I'm guessing because his family was very professional. He had a brother who was an engineer. His other brother was a scientist. His father was a scientist. That maybe law was the thing they thought he should go into. And he really didn't he was okay at it, but he didn't like it. And he even convinced another friend that, your dream is music. This was a friend of the family. And this person was working in business. Your dream is music. Go for the music. So he was convincing him to follow his dream like he followed his dream because his real calling was writing.
You also point out that one of the reasons why he might have felt, you know, that the legal career wasn't for him was, as you describe, at this time where he's embracing this radical political identity and he's beginning to submit writings to radical publications, he's serving as a lawyer for a gas company.
Right, I know. That was one. I did find that court case, and I was surprised about that. Although some of the other lawyers he worked for were fairly progressive, you know, for the law offices, were fairly progressive and maybe not radical, but more progressive than others.
So you describe how his, you know, he really sees himself much more as a writer. I was wondering if you could describe a bit his writing at this stage of his life. Here we're talking about, this is like the early teens, 1905, 1910. And he is, as you explained, he is trying to find not just his niche in life, but he's also trying to define himself as a writer. And as you explained, he is exploring a lot of different types of writing during this period.
Right. He was trying to be a playwright for a while, and he was a little bit involved with some of the local New York City, which is, I guess, where you want to be if you're a playwright. He was kind of involved with them. There was a playwright named Paul Kester, and he was sort of a mentor to him, I guess. But he never had anything produced. And that was in his early 20s. But he was doing other kinds of writings, too. He was doing short stories. He was doing plays. And in 1912, it was a real coup. He got a short story in a magazine called The Forum. And other writers who wrote for The Forum were Ezra Pound and Edna St. Vincent Millay. So that was a real coup for him. But it was really the only short story that he had published. And then he kind of moved on to journalism at that point. So he worked for the New York World, and the Evening Post was the big one that he started for in the teens, 1900s. And then Evening Post back then was very liberal, very progressive, as opposed to what the Post might be considered now. They were kind of fighting for social justice issues, a lot of the same kinds of social justice issues that are talked about today. And in 1914, he managed to get an article in The Masses, which was a pretty radical publication. So, he was kind of moving into that lifestyle and moving into, knowing people in the village, Greenwich Village, and, kind of becoming part of that community.
It's interesting that he becomes associated with that community because a lot of the people from that community end up playing this very prominent role in not just left-wing politics in the United States and left-wing journalism in the United States during this period, but then they also go to Europe during the First World War and afterward and become this very important conduit of information to the United States. And you situate Henry Alsberg in that group, and you describe his travels, but he also had this very unusual role as this government official. He and he associates with some very important people like Henry Morgenthau, and is unlike a lot of these other writers, he also is much more familiar with the Middle East during this period as well.
Yeah, he moved between a lot of different worlds, and I think because of his family. He moved between the intellectual German Jews from his youth, the Wilson Woodrow Wilson Democrats, anarchist Russian Jews, nonconformists from Greenwich Village, bohemians, the liberals at the Evening Post, radicals at the Masses. So part of it was from his family connections, and part of it was from the people he met, you know, on his own. And when he, you know, as you know, he went to Turkey as the assistant to the ambassador, and this was during World War One, but before the United States was involved in World War One. So he was this was after Henry Morgenthau came back home, and there was another ambassador, and he went along with that ambassador. But later on, he did work with Henry Morgenthau in Eastern Europe. So and I think a lot of it was because his brother, who worked in Washington at the Bureau of Chemistry, but it became the FDA. A lot of it was because of his brother's contacts. So, yeah, he moved between a lot of different worlds. Not, you know, like most people didn't do that.
I've had it especially interesting because you describe how it was during this period that though he never becomes religious, he starts to become much more aware and involved with Jewish political activism, particularly his work for the Joint Distribution Committee, but also through that, he has this contact with this, this Zionist movement, which during the war, it has this dramatic advance in terms of the Balfour Declaration. And you describe how he's in contact with this growing community of Jewish political activists in the Middle East, and how helps him to assess and develop his own identity as a politician and as an activist.
Right, he did. Well, it started in Turkey, where he saw, I mean, the Armenians were the ones who were really faced genocide, but there was a Jewish population in Turkey as well, and they were suffering also. And that's where he met the people from the JDC and different activist organizations. And then later, again, he met them in Paris when he was working. He was sent to Paris. He was sent to as a foreign correspondent for The Nation, I guess, right at the end of World War One. And so he crisscrossed from, you know, working for The Nation, writing articles, to working for the JDC, and it all kind of intersected together. But he was really attracted towards Jewish causes and his cultural roots, and it didn't come from what he was brought up with. It didn't come from his family home. It came from what he was seeing at different places in Eastern Europe and the horror he was seeing with the pogroms and reporting on that, and then trying to help them, and then putting himself in danger where he was, you know, going through these small Central and Eastern European towns and, you know, bringing people money to help them survive and things like that. So, you know, it was really a time where there were these conflicts post-World War One, post the armistice, and he was kind of moving in that arena as a journalist and as a relief worker, as both.
As you describe in the book, he wears his politics on his sleeve, and he's not the modern, let's air both sides, journalist. He's very much of a partisan. You describe that a lot of his journalism. And given some of the things that he witnessed during that period, the communist revolution in Hungary in 1919, as you described the pogroms, the aftermath of the Armenian genocide, he definitely is a person who had a very evident reaction to that and let that come through in his writing.
Yeah, I think he almost took it personally. And he did let it come through in his writing. And like I said, he would kind of do double duty writing about, different places in Poland, different places, and the politics of it too. Czechoslovakia, which was a new country, so he would write about that. And some of it, you know, I read a lot of articles, and you can't fit everything into a book. And some of it was a little bit more objective than others, but a lot of it was quite subjective. So,
He also, during this period, cements his friendship with Emma Goldman. I thought that was a particularly interesting one because of both where he is and where they go. And it seems to be the point at which he is most clearly identifiable as an anarchist, which is an identity that, as you explained, he subsequently sort of, evolves out of.
Right, right. I don't know if he evolved out of anarchism. He was described, and I'm not sure exactly what this means, as a philosophical anarchist. But when he first met Emma Goldman, he was interested in the Soviet, as he called it, their experiment. And he was in favor of it. And then as he saw, and he became very close to Emma Goldman, and she was in favor of it too. She was actually exiled from the United States to the Soviet Union for her activism in the United States. And they became, when they met, they became very close, actually. And she was kind of like a mother figure to him, I think. And I found so many letters between them, maybe dozens of letters, maybe 100. And they were very personal letters where they really talked about their what they felt about, you know, life and, you know, their own lives. And you know, a lot of emotions were expressed in these letters. But at first, they were both in favor of the Russian Revolution. But then as they saw some of the fascist events happening, they both pulled away from that. And she left Russia. And he turned against the communism part of it. I think he was still a socialist, a philosophical anarchist, and then, of course, a New Dealer. So, but they did turn against it. Although it did come back to bite him, you know, he was considered by, in the 1930s when he was, I mean, I'm kind of jumping ahead, but when he worked for the WPA and then the House Un-American Committee was investigating him, they basically said he was a communist. And he really wasn't. He was actually he was an anti-communist. So it hurt him, but he did spend a lot of time in the Soviet Union. And he saw some things he liked, but he also saw a lot of the negative things.
You described, though, that he tended to be initially far more excusing of a lot of the problems. And you describe how,
yes,
as Emma Goldman was, you know, rapidly souring on the direction that the Soviet regime was taking Russia, that Alsberg tended to be more excusing of the suspension of civil liberties and basically, you know, treating it as a temporary thing, whereas Emma Goldman had more of a sense that this wasn't temporary, this was the direction that the regime was going.
Right. He blamed the lack, you know, the problems in the Soviet Union on the Western blockades, the long years of war, the battle. He thought it would change. He praised the Soviets for their vaccination programs, their educational system, for their arts programs. And they had a lot of fights. They had arguments about it, until he eventually kind of came around to see her way of thinking.
It was interesting how throughout that period he remained involved with relief. You describe how even into the early 1920s, he's with the Joint Distribution Committee. He's involved with Herbert Hoover's American Relief Administration when they're dealing with the famine in the Ukraine. So he still is straddling those worlds. And in a sense, by doing both, he's able to have the best of both worlds. He's both able to, in a sense, advocate for his cause, understand his cause, get to travel, but also he's working to try to achieve it through his relief work.
Yeah, I think part of it was, and Emma Goldman said this, she thought that his heart ached more, and this is her quote, when Jews were being persecuted. So despite his upbringing, he did feel more connected to Jewish population, and then the things he saw, it really affected him greatly. So that's what she saw, what Emma Goldman saw. So when he went back, I think it was the second time that he worked for the JDC, the Joint Distribution Committee. It was probably less out of what he saw as a great you know, Soviet experiment as it was to help the Jewish population.
It was interesting reading about how often he went back and forth, because I'm thinking as I'm reading this that, you know, nowadays this is sort of we take for granted. People can hop on a plane and be there in a few hours, and this idea of living this transatlantic life is something so many of us could take for granted. But he was doing it in the days of steamships, and yet he was making this journey several times over the course of this, not just his life, but just this period of, say, the 19-teens into the 1920s.
Yeah, I think there were about, I think I counted 6 or 7 transatlantic journeys from the late 1918. Actually, there was one more before that. Until his last one was, I think, 1931. So, yeah, and these weren't short trips. It wasn't just jumping on a plane. These were long trips. However, he had some family money at that point. He didn't always later on, but in that period, I think he was able, and plus the nation was paying him at least some money. So he was able to not, you know, he wasn't in steerage. He was in a better class of a room. So, but still, you know, these were trips that were, you know, maybe a week long. And one of the trips he came back, you know, he was also, because he was doing so many different things, nobody knew what he really thought. So the Soviets arrested him at one point. They thought he was a spy. And then the FBI, the Americans, were investigating him, and they thought he was a Bolshevik spy too. So, you know, everybody thought he was a spy for the other side, and he really wasn't. He was mostly just a journalist and a worker for the refugees.
I love that story about his arrest that you describe in the book, and I was wondering if you could recount it, because it's such a funny story, and I think it speaks to Henry Alsberg himself, his self-confidence in terms of how, you know, that arrest played out the way that it did.
Yeah, he seemed to have a sense of humor about it, which is kind of funny. And I wish, you know, there was an article he wrote for The Nation where he talked about writing in his diary. And, of course, you know, there was, if he wrote a diary, it's not to be found now. But as the incident was described, he got the arresting officer drunk. And when they got to Moscow, you know, the semi-conscious officer, you know, it accompanied him to the police station. And Henry Alsberg said, "Here's the man you sent out to find me." And supposedly he spent several weeks in jail. There were a couple of different accounts of that. But he did testify when he testified for House Un-American Activities Committee. He said he spent several weeks in jail. So, and the other thing I found that was, I had a lot of fun doing the research. One thing I found was a letter that Emma Goldman wrote to Lenin to try to get him out of jail. So that was kind of interesting.
So he's very involved in these activities in Europe, and yet as the 1920s wears on, he's living more in the United States, and he's beginning to go back into writing plays. And I was wondering if you'd explain what was happening during this period with the Provincetown Playhouse and then his involvement with Dubuc.
Oh, okay. So, yeah, he was back and forth a lot. I mean, the 1920s, if you looked at, you know, a zigzag line of where he went, you know, you'd have New York, Eastern Europe, Paris, London. He went to California to visit his brother and to do some writing. So he was all over the place. But he did spend a lot of time in the United States. And he had a childhood friend. Her name was Stella Bloch Hanau, and she worked for the Provincetown Playhouse. And she probably helped him get a job there. And he was a producer, and he was also an associate producer, and he did all sorts of things, you know, working with the Provincetown Playhouse. He worked with Eugene O'Neill. He worked with a lot of different people. And one of the biggest, most important plays that they did that he helped produce was Abraham's Bosom, which was it revolved around racial justice, and it was about African Americans. And at this time, that was kind of a controversial play to produce. So he did a lot of different things with, he helped produce one of Eugene O'Neill's plays. And then the other thing around the, like in the same time, you know, he was walking across downtown more to the neighborhood playhouse, where he was involved in writing a play called The Dybbuk. And the Dybbuk was originally written in Yiddish, and he was able to get the right to translate it into English for the English-speaking stage. And it became, he did that for the Neighborhood Playhouse. It was sort of a mystical play. It was described as sort of a melding of Fiddler on the Roof, The Exorcist, and Romeo and Juliet. And very mystical. And it was a hit. And it did really well. And the show sold out. The run, you know, started small, but it extended. New York Times theater critics really gave it great reviews. And then the really interesting thing to me was that I found out that George Gershwin loved the show, and he wanted to do his first full-length opera of the Dybbuk, and it was supposed to be at the Metropolitan Opera House. They signed contracts. It was supposed to open in 1931, I think it was. So Henry Olsberg would have been the, you know, would have been involved with this play, which would have been Gershwin's first full-length opera. But then there was a glitch in the copyright, and the stock market crashed, and it didn't happen. And then Gershwin's first full-length opera wasn't the Dybbuk, it was Porgy and Bess. But it could have been the Dybbuk, so that would have changed his life completely. So I thought that was kind of interesting. And it was hard on him because, you know, here you're about to embark on this Metropolitan Opera House extravaganza, and then it doesn't happen. So it kind of sent him into a depression.
And as you describe, that then was compounded by the nationwide depression, and he was really struggling during the early 1930s to establish a living for himself. To, you know, he seems to be a little unmoored. He's sort of drifting, trying to find something. Nothing's quite catching.
Yeah, and he was, you know, at one point, like 10 years before, he was a very well-respected foreign correspondent. And then he was unmoored. He couldn't finish projects. He would start, you know, he started an autobiography, which he probably didn't finish because it's nowhere to be found. He started doing other things. He considered moving to a cooperative farm in Detroit that some friends had started, but he really didn't think he would be happy there. So he was really disconnected from everything. He was, thank goodness, able to reconnect with some people in New York City, kind of the American network of writers and artists, and also some government and civic officials, also probably with the help of his brother, right before, right as Roosevelt was elected. But yeah, he had a hard time. He suffered from depression. I mean, I couldn't put a psychological diagnosis in the book because that wasn't really my job. But it seemed from, you know, a lot of the letters that I read that he wrote to Emma Goldman, because he was very open with her. But it did seem like he suffered from, you know, severe depression at some times.
How is it that he becomes part of the New Deal workforce?
Okay, so here he was back in America trying to find himself, trying to decide if he wants to go, you know, work on a farm. And at the same time, President Roosevelt was elected. His brother was appointed to a commission to study international economic conditions and advise President Roosevelt. And then he had some other friends. He had a friend who was assistant to a senator, and Henry Morgenthau Jr., who was the son of Henry Morgenthau Sr., of course, and Henry had known him through the JDC. He also knew Felix Frankfurter, who he advised earlier, many years earlier. So he knew all these different people, and one was an acquaintance from New York, another writer, and this man was named Jacob Baker, and he was able to secure a position in the New Deal's Federal Emergency Relief Administration, which was called FERA, because there's a lot of acronyms when you start talking about the New Deal. WPA, FERA. So FERA came before the WPA. And this man, Jacob Baker, hired Henry to work for the publications division of FERA. So that's how he got into the New Deal. And one of the books he wrote, actually the book he wrote in that period, was America Fights the Depression, which is a really beautiful book. It's still, you know, I have a copy. It's a very sturdy, large format book with a lot of beautiful photos, and it promoted the accomplishments of the Civil Works Administration, which was part of FERA. So that's how we got into the New Deal, I guess.
But FERA itself was designed to be temporary, so after that period, there is this recognition that more needs to be done, and that's when the WPA is created. And then Alsberg makes this transition that you describe, thanks to Harry Hopkins.
Yeah, Harry Hopkins said something like, you know, because most of the project, a lot of the projects, most of the projects that people remember are the public works projects, you know, roads and hospitals and things like that, and things that are still here today. The murals came later, but all sorts of things that they built, swimming pools in cities, all sorts of public works projects. And Harry Hopkins said, well, something to the effect of writers and artists have to eat too. And what was what they designed was the federal, it was called Federal Project Number 1, and it encompassed the theater, the art, the Music and Writers Project. And it didn't happen until maybe later in the summer of 1935. They kind of worked on it off time, and Henry Alsberg was involved with the discussions. And then when it came to be, and they created Federal One for real, those four programs, he was chosen as the Writers Project Director. Probably because of his involvement with FERA and the Writing and Publications Division.
What was Alsberg like as an administrator?
Well, he was seen. He was seen as not a good administrator. He was criticized. They thought he had bad management abilities. You know, I kind of refute that a little bit. I mean, he wasn't the perfect administrator, but I think because he was a little bit more artsy, and he had a kind of a eccentric personality, I think that brought a lot of the creative aspects to the Writers Project that might not have been, an official guide to the United States was what they set out to do. And I think if he were the perfect administrator, not so visionary maybe, it wouldn't have had the literary quality that it ended up having. You know, maybe it would have been a tour guide that would be used not as something. They were more creative than that. They weren't just tour guides.
I was wondering if you could explain that a bit more, the American guide, because you described the development of the project, and it really was this very fascinating project, and it's one that, as you explained, you know, in many ways still endures to this day.
Well, they started as thinking that it would be a 5-volume American guide, and they would divide it into regional sections. And then it kind of expanded into, it wouldn't just be lodgings and landmarks and automobile routes, which was at first was supposed to be. They started including cultural aspects of different cities and states. They wanted to include cultural, he was a visionary, I guess, and he looked at civil rights as something to include. He looked at including immigrants and African Americans in these books, so they wanted to put this into the books, actually. And then there ended up being books for every state, and they had fantastic writers. So they ended up with natural resources besides, you know, tour routes, and they had cultural essays, scientific essays. They had critical acclaim for their literary writing. Some were bestsellers. One of the books, which was the Washington book, which was the second one to be published, included a section that was written by Sterling Brown, who was appointed as the African-American director for the Federal Writers Project. And it was critical of you know, Washington, D.C. and how it treated African Americans. And, you know, so that was really quite visionary to keep that in. And then actually after Henry Ellsberg was fired, they changed that essay and they kind of toned it down a little bit. So
you also described his efforts to get Zora Neale Hurston involved, how she was working on the Florida book, but ultimately his efforts to get her appointed as an editor were frustrated.
Yeah, they were. And, you know, well, it was Florida. It was the South and it was in the 1930s. He did the best. I think she got paid a little bit more than she was supposed to, but, you know, she couldn't be in charge of anything. She couldn't be a real administrator. She did have some more freedom than perhaps other people had because of her status. I mean, she was already a writer and a famous folklorist, so she deserved to have a better position. But, you know, because of the time, she didn't.
You also mentioned one other project that he did, which I think speaks to his idea and his efforts, and that was the Slave Oral Histories. And you describe it's not a project that he initiated, but it's definitely one that he put the backing of the FWP behind.
Wait, which histories did you say?
The oral histories of the former slaves.
Oh, yeah, that was amazing. And that was... Benjamin Botkin was really kind of spearheaded that. And yeah, so there are about, I think about 3,000 or so histories of former slaves. And these were people, you know, they had a deadline because these were people in their 80s and 90s. And they had a deadline of them, you know, being very old. And they sent people out to interview them. And it wasn't perfect. I mean, honestly, in the South, some of the interviews they used, you know, they kind of, they're not looked at as really great histories because of how the interviewer wrote them up. But others are really telling. So, you know, and you can look online at the Library of Congress website and you can find them. So it's really, for educators, it would be really interesting. It's really interesting to use because you can see what they remembered. And some of the, you know, it's horrific what they remember. You know, one man talking about he's 5 years old and his parents are taken away from him. And, you know, or seeing his father being whipped, you know, really horrific things. Yeah, so that they actually managed to get thousands of those oral histories. And they did the same with a lot of immigrants, too, which is interesting. If you look also on the Library of Congress website, they have a lot of them. Not all of them, but a lot of them.
What was it that ultimately brought Ellsberg to the attention of the House Committee on Un-American Activities?
He was sort of all along they were being criticized from the time they started by more conservative members of Congress, you know, Southern Democrats and Republicans, basically saying they were a communist outfit. And part of it was they didn't support Roosevelt, and they would do anything to bring him down. So, you know, they were on their radar all along. And then when some of the books came out, some of the American guidebooks came out, they would look at these books and say, okay, this is, you know, a radical agenda that these people have. Like, for instance, the Massachusetts guidebook talked about Sacco and Vanzetti, and they thought this was horrible, you know, to talk about these anarchists in this book. And I can't remember what the exact wording was, but Sacco and Vanzetti had more, had 13 lines or 16 lines or something like that in the book, and Paul Revere only had, I forgot what it was, maybe five or something. That's not the exact number, but you know they were mad that Paul Revere had fewer amount of lines than the Sacco and Vanzetti story. So they just saw them as radicals, and actually a lot of them were, you know, progressives, and maybe some of them were radicals, but they were just the committee. The House Un-American Activity Committee was formed in I think it was 1938 or 1937. And they were determined to prove that the arts projects were full of communists. And they didn't really have the desire to separate the truth from, you know, the fanciful, I guess. So it started pretty early on.
And Ellsberg's background made him an obvious target.
Right. They saw that And yeah, they saw that he traveled in the Soviet Union, and they knew, they didn't know how friendly he was with Emma Goldman. I mean, when he was testifying in front of UAC, he didn't quite own up to how close he was to her. He said he knew her, you know. Yeah, we were acquaintances, but he didn't quite own up to it because it would have looked, you know, it would have made it very difficult. But when they did interview him, and he talked about writing a book about political prisoners in the Soviet Union, they thought he was referring to prisoners under the Tsarist regime, and he was talking about under the Soviet regime. And they were kind of surprised because, you know, they thought he was this communist, and he was really in, he was really an anti-communist, and he was blacklisted from some of his friends who were communists. So, yeah, so it came early on, really, and they just went after him. They also went after the Federal Theater Project as much as they went after him.
So did he ultimately leave the FWP on his own terms, or was he, in effect, driven out?
He was driven out. It was between UAC, House Un-American Activities Committee, and then other later congressional committees, you know, budgeting committees, things like that. They were just looking for anything to get rid of him, and also to close the Writers Project, to close the Theater Project. And the Theater Project went first. They just closed it down. And then what happened was he had written a letter to the Nation in 1929, I think it was, which talked about political prisoners and, you know, kind of took a liberal viewpoint of why these prisoners were in jail and prison reform. He believed in prison reform. And the things he wrote, they kind of went back and found, and they used that to go after him. And basically, the new person who took over, Harry Hopkins was gone by then. Harry Hopkins was a big supporter of the Federal Writers Project and the Federal Theaters Project. And a new person took over, Colonel Harrington. And he was not as he was not as in favor of these projects, and he wanted him to be fired. And this was as the books were rolling off the presses, the American guidebooks and children's books and books about African-Americans and books about different ethnic groups were rolling off the presses. And Henry Ellsberg was just really trying to make sure that these books, which were, you know, being produced very regularly, he wanted to make sure they were published. And they fired him, and he wouldn't leave, which is kind of interesting. He just wouldn't leave for about maybe a couple of weeks because he wanted to make sure that these books, you know, survive the publication process. So that's sort of how it ended.
He ends this period of his life, and it's obviously a very difficult period for him. But he, at the same time, he is the former head of a federal agency. He has all his contacts, and yet it seems that the rest, the he lives for another 31 years. But the rest of his life seems almost anticlimactic in some ways.
Yeah, it does. I think you know, part of he did go back and into to Washington to work for the Office of War Information, which is, I found sort of strange because he was a pacifist. But he also, I think, by that point needed the money. You know, he had some family money before that, but I think he kind of didn't have that family money anymore. His brother Carl, by that time, had died. His mother had died, you know, because very often he would go back to live with his mother in New York City, but by the early 1930s she had passed away. So he didn't have – he actually had to work. By then, he couldn't just go travel around and volunteer for causes and things like that. So anyway, he worked for the Office of War Information until he was accused of homosexuality, and which was the kind of thing you can accuse somebody of then, and he lost that job. So he did go back to New York City. He lived in Greenwich Village, and interestingly, he lived right next door to the Stonewall Inn, which, you know, it was before the Stonewall Inn became famous for what it became famous for. But he lived, I have a photo of him, of his building right next to the Stonewall Inn, which was kind of interesting. But his life did change a little bit. He kind of stepped back. And he was also not that young by then. So he was probably, let's see, he was probably 60 by then. So he was kind of winding down his work life, I guess. And he did manage to get an editorial job with Hastings House, which was one of the publishers that published a lot of the Writers Project's books. So, you know, that kept him working in New York City. And eventually he moved to Palo Alto, California, where his sister lived. And they lived together in California. And he did travel around, and he still wrote. He wrote a lot of private things, short stories, plays, nothing that was published. And a lot of it was about his sexuality, so it couldn't be published at that point. And this was in the probably 50s, very early 60s. He did remain friends with a man named Vincent McHugh, who's another really interesting person. He was the editor of some of the New York City Writers Project books, which are beautifully written. And he was a poet, and he moved to San Francisco. And they stayed friends for many years, so I have a lot of letters between those two. You know, so Henry Alsberg was a little bit not involved in the beat scene, the beat writing scene, but Vincent McHugh was. So he kind of had a little bit of a connection to that, in that he, you know, heard about it from his younger friend Vincent.
That was what I found kind of surprising about that part of his life, which is that in so many ways, he seems to be this natural elder statesman, not so much just necessarily the political left, but also this kind of cultural left. And in that sense, it is rather surprising to read about how, in a sense, he doesn't play that role. It's the position that he should have assumed, but ultimately didn't. And that seemed a little strange.
Yeah, it's hard to say why. I forgot to mention that one of the things he did was he wrote a book called Let's Talk About the Peace, which was basically a pacifist book. He saw that I guess he didn't really like how the United Nations was going. He didn't really see peace coming after World War II. So he wrote that book, and it, you know, got some good reviews. But, yeah, he did pull back a lot from, you know, being a public persona. I think he was also very insulted about being fired from the Writers Project because he didn't always want to talk about it. There was a man named Jerry Manjone who wrote a book called The Dream and the Deal, and that's what really brought the Federal Writers Project back into the public eye, I think. And after that, there were a lot of books, more books written about it. And I think by then Henry was, I guess, in his 80s, and he really didn't want to be interviewed, and he didn't want to be that involved in the whole process. So I think there was a sort of feeling insulted about being fired from what he saw as a very important role.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
What I'm working on now is I'm trying to find the time to spread the word about this book, because I think Henry Alsberg was a really important person in American life, and I would like more people to know about him. I've become a little bit more involved with other groups that talk about the New Deal. The Living New Deal is a group in out of Berkeley, and they're doing a lot of stuff also to spread the word about the good works of the New Deal. I was really lucky a couple of weeks ago to meet Franklin Roosevelt's grandson, whose name is Franklin Roosevelt. So I'm just trying to get more involved with groups like that, and also just, you know, find a way to spread the word about Henry Alsberg and the work he did in his life.
Thank you very much for taking some time to spread the word here at the New Books Network about the book. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thank you so much, and I hope you do too, and I'm happy to talk to you. Thank you.